When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
First for breaking news and the best live sport.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Good evening and welcome to Science Night on 5 Live. I'm Dr. Chris Smith, and with my fellow naked scientists, between now and 9pm, we'll be delving into the world of microbiology to discover what's living on us and in us, and how these bugs can control whether we gain weight or stay slim, how they cause disease, and new ways to stop them. Plus, we'll show you how you can build your own laser pointer-powered microscope to see what's living in your lavatory. All that, plus your calls, emails, texts and tweets. Call us on 0500 909 693 or text 85. 5058. The lines are open now.
5 Live Science Night. Call with your questions. 0500 909 693.
This is Science Night on 5 Live with the naked scientists Chris Smith and Victoria Gill, and our kitchen scientists Dave Ansell and Ben Fausler. In this hour, we're putting the world of microbes under the microscope. How do the bugs living in us and on us affect how healthy we are, or even how likely we are to gain weight? With us are Manchester microbiologist Joe Verrin, who works on how bacteria grow, Justin Sonnenberg, who's at Stanford in California. He looks at how microbes lend us genes to help us break down foods that we would otherwise not be able to consume, and Nottingham microbiologist Liz Sockett studies a parasitic microbe that hunts down, invades and destroys other bacteria and might be useful as a living antibiotic to treat a range of infections.
So let's have your science questions and comments for them, please. Phone in now on 0500 909 693 or text 85058. You can, of course, watch us on the webcam at bbc.co.uk/5live, and you can email or tweet us as well.
Brain Power, Science Night on 5 Live.
The microbes that live on us and in us outnumber our own cells by 50 to 1. And that means that we're almost passengers in our own bodies. Now, some of these bugs are beneficial, but others can be very harmful. Manchester Metropolitan University microbiologist Joe Verrin is working on ways to stop bad bugs from growing on surfaces where they're not wanted. And that includes operating tables, worktops and even false teeth. Hello, Joe.
Hi.
With normal teeth, not false teeth.
Yeah,
it's not self-interest that's motivating this. How are you doing this?
Well, we're interested in two different areas. One is the organisms actually surviving on surfaces where they can't particularly grow. And the other is where they have the opportunity to grow and form biofilms. So they're two very different sorts of environments.
What's a biofilm?
A biofilm is a community of microorganisms on a surface. So the organisms are stuck on a surface and they have the opportunity to grow. It's usually where you have liquid running over solids. So, say, in your water pipes or in your mouth, across your teeth, across your dentures if you had them. So it's a solid liquid interface. And so the liquid that's flowing over those microorganisms brings food to them and takes away their waste products. So they're able to multiply and produce these rather beautiful looking biofilms, actually.
So why is a biofilm bad?
Not all biofilms are bad. The vast majority of microorganisms attached on the surface are attached on surfaces all over the planet. And biofilms and microbiology often gets a bad name, but actually the vast majority of microorganisms are very lovely. There are some...
Nice of you to say. Sticking up for the humble microbe.
So on our body, we are, as you already said, heaving with microorganisms, and those are called our commensal flora, our normal flora. And we live very happily with them, and they actually help keep... pathogenic microorganisms at bay. So the biofilms that we have on our skin and in our gut and in our mouths are very much part of our normal flora. So it's the incoming pathogens that we want to keep at bay.
How can you stop them doing this? What are you doing with these surfaces that might be able to disrupt the ability to form these biofilms?
Well, when we look at surfaces that are exposed to the air, the organisms don't really have opportunity to grow. So if you look at things like any contact surfaces that you might frequently touch, there isn't really a lot of food there, but the organisms can be deposited on those surfaces and can survive potentially until they're given the opportunity to, perhaps to be transferred onto somewhere else where they could grow. So, for example, from a chicken leg onto a chopping board and then onto another piece of meat and then into your mouth, for example. So by keeping the surfaces as clean as possible and therefore making sure that the surfaces are perhaps particularly hard and resistant to wear, but also very easy to clean, are some of the strategies that we can have to maintain hygienic surfaces.
What about actually actively stopping things growing on surfaces? Aren't people producing surfaces that leach various chemicals or are impregnated with things that bugs really hate, so they avoid them like the plague? Excuse the pun.
There are lots of strategies to make surfaces antimicrobial. There are some ways that you can put chemicals in them. There are other ways that you can modify their physical properties. So making sure that they are smooth and hard is a way of making it easier to remove organisms from them. People are putting in, some of the work that we have been doing is putting essential oils into surfaces. Essential oils are often antimicrobial, and we can help to prevent organisms from being able to multiply on those surfaces where the essential oils are. Another way is we have titanium dioxide, which becomes antimicrobial when it's irradiated. So that's, again, a physical way of disposing of the microorganisms on the surface. Another way, of course, is by putting in some sort of toxic chemical that leaches out of the surface and kills the microorganisms. But that's not particularly desirable, because the surface is active and you don't really want that necessarily.
If you've got a comment or a question for us, call in now. It's 0500 909 693 on the telephone, or you can text in on 85058 or email chris@thenakedscientist.com. We're talking microbiology.
And we do have a caller online. We have Bavish in London who has a question that, Joe, you might be able to help with. Bavish, what's your question?
Good evening, everyone. Thank you. It's a brilliant show. Basically, the question is, look, with all these discoveries of exoplanets that we know are fairly ubiquitous, even in our galaxy, and with Kepler and other telescopes, with micro lensing and so forth, But see, with the chemical signatures that we're getting feedback of different exoplanets and so forth, So if you look at the chemistry of our own planet itself, you leave a loaf of bread or something unattended a few days, you've got bacteria and so forth, fungus, it will grow.
I'm not coming around your house for lunch, Bavish. So I guess what you're asking is, what's the likelihood that we've got life flourishing on other planets as well? Because an exoplanet means a planet orbiting a star, not our own. So what do you think, Joe? What's the likelihood of ubiquity of life elsewhere in the galaxy, in the universe, perhaps?
From a chopping board up to... I would think in the vast expanse of space there would be the possibility of something, I would think. And if it were going to be anything, it would quite possibly be microorganisms. They are the most successful living thing on our planet. They've been here the longest, and they are hugely diverse in terms of their metabolic abilities. So some of them can use a whole range of different, really unusual materials as their energy source. So if there is anything... it's probably going to be microbial.
One quick one to sneak in. Terry Lloyd on the text, Joe, wonders, talking of all kinds of things you can live on, how is it that cats and dogs can lick their bums and keep it clean? But if humans did that, we would be very ill. Now, is that a myth? Is
how
it true?
Do you know that?
Well, exactly. That's what I'm going to say. Do we know that? If I were able to, I'm not a contortionist, but were I able to lick my own bum clean, would I likely succumb to some kind of nasty infection, or would actually I be okay?
I mean, look, you must have read 50 Shades of Grey. There's all
Actually,
sorts of things going on.
Clearly you have. But here you can, I can use my imagination.
Later Christmas
present
for you,
Chris. Let me think about a nice way to put this.
You can put it a nasty way if you like.
There are ways of passing disease. It's called the fecal-oral route, in fact. So that is one of the ways of transmitting disease that can cause sort of gut infection. So that is the fecal-oral route. So there obviously is a way of doing it.
Viruses will go that way, won't they?
Viruses will do it. There's loads of microorganisms. So cholera is one, in fact, as well. And then there are... herpes viruses and many other ones.
So I'd probably best avoid it then. Well, sticking with that bit of the body, our intestines are home to billions of bacteria. Previously, we thought they were just these microbial freeloaders, but now we're beginning to realise that they actually do make a massive contribution to human health, and they can even control whether we put on weight or stay slim. Justin Sonnenberg is a microbiologist from Stanford University in California, and he works on the relationship we have with our intestinal flora. Hello, Justin.
Hello.
So when we talk about good bacteria, what are they?
Yeah, well, it's been appreciated for quite some time that, hundreds of years, that there are microorganisms that live on and in our bodies. But really, there's been this explosion of research over the past 5 to 10 years that has really mapped the complexity and density of these communities in various body sites. This community is known as the microbiota, and it's become clear that it's wired in and controls many facets of our biology. You hit on a really important point at the top of the show, Chris, that these microbes that live on our bodies outnumber our human cells by somewhere on the order of 10 to 100 fold. And so that means by cell number, we're actually more microbial than we are human. And so while most people think of the human body as a collection of human cells, it's actually a composite organism that's composed of both human cells and microbial cells that come together to work in a really integrated fashion that is still poorly understood and very complex. We tend to think of the human genome as encoding these proteins that constitute our biology, but really there's a second genome that greatly influences our biology, the collective genome of these microbial communities that's known as the microbiome. And this collective genome encodes somewhere on the order or includes on the order of a hundredfold more, or maybe even as many as 1,000-fold more genes than our human genome. And so there's really a vast complexity of genetics that is associated with our body that we're just beginning to understand.
So, Justin, maybe you could comment on that sort of battle between good and bad bacteria, if there's any sense or clinical evidence for the good of taking probiotics. We've got a question from Mac in Norfolk, who said he was taking a course of good bacterial probiotics after taking a course of antibiotics, and is this going to do anything beneficial for him?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. So, the battle between good and bad bacteria is an interesting one, both from a biological perspective and also a scientific research perspective. Historically, over the past 100 years, there's been a major focus of research on the bad pathogenic bacteria that cause disease. And we're just beginning to appreciate now that they're actually just a small fraction of the microbes that are important to our biology. And when we do something like take antibiotics, it wreaks havoc on this resident community. And so while we may eradicate a pathogen, there's actually a trade-off there, and we disrupt this normal commensal microbiota, and in doing so, open the door for other diseases to take hold and other pathogens to take off and do more damage. And
Pete's agreeing with you on the text, 85058, Justin. He says 97% of all the bugs that we hold are harmless or friendly, and the best way to fight bacteria is not to go to your doctor asking for antibiotics, a sensible but paranoid precaution in personal life. He says he's a doctor. We've actually had a lot of headlines created here recently with people saying there is over-prescription of antibiotics. And I think you've hit on a very important point there, which is when we give people antibiotics, it does actually damage that very unique flora they have inside them, doesn't it? So what could be the consequences? Because one of the things that people have been looking at is weight and why microbes might make a difference to how much you weigh. Could actually taking antibiotics affect your weight? Because farm animals fed antibiotics get fatter, don't they?
Yeah, so there's some preliminary data. Marty Blazer's group at NYU has some interesting research suggesting that long-term use of antibiotics at low levels in an animal model can actually result in increased weight gain. So just the disturbance of the normal microbiota for a long period of time. The mechanism by which farm animals gain weight more rapidly when they're using or administered antibiotics is still poorly understood. And really, there's been much association in the past 5 years between human metabolism and the microbiota, and the suggestion that the microbiota may influence things like obesity, metabolic syndrome, and diabetes. And there clearly are associations, but the mechanistic links as to how the microbes in our body are actually doing this, what leads from the microbes to our metabolism, is an area that's under very active investigation and still fairly poorly understood.
And sorry to cut across you there. And on that topic, actually, of farm animals, we have a call from Douglas in Knighton. He's got a question for you, Justin. Douglas, what's your question?
My question is, we're allegedly concerned about obesity, and yet people boast about putting growth enhancers in the animal feed. So what's your opinion about that?
Well, goal of many farmers is to make their animals as big and productive in as short a period of time as possible. And this contrasts with what is optimal for humans, which is not to become as big as quickly as possible. And so there are certainly different strategies there, but maybe some common mechanisms in play.
Justin Sonnenberg from Stanford, please stay with us. Alan is on the phone from Newton Abbot in Devon. Wants to talk to you, Joe.
Okay.
Fire away, Alan.
Well, hi. Yes, I'm in Dawlish in Devon.
Hello.
Could you tell me how often you should change your chopping boards in the kitchen? Chopping boards.
I think the main thing is that you you keep your chopping board well wiped and clean. I don't know how quickly you have to. You don't have to change them that regularly. Just make sure that you clean it very thoroughly with hot water. Don't chop raw food and then use the same chopping board for cooked food afterwards. It's sort of basic hygiene, really.
We've actually got another question about chopping boards on the text, Joe, from Henry in Halesmere. He wants to know what type is the best type of chopping board to use for hygiene. Is there a type that you would recommend?
Well, personally, I use a plastic one and make sure that I wash it in very hot water in the dishwasher. People use wood chopping boards because it's believed that some of the tannins that can come out of wood can have sort of antimicrobial properties. But again, with wood chopping boards, you need to make sure that they're well dried as well.
Thank you, Joe. Joe Verrin from Manchester Metropolitan University. If you have a question about anything microbiology, infectivity, or perhaps even norovirus, then give us a call here. It's Science Night with the Naked Scientists on 5 Live. The phone number 0500 909 693, the text number 85058. You can also email us, chris@thenakedscientist.com, or you can tweet @NakedScientist. Now, still to come on Science Night. Naked Scientists, caught short, will be going down the toilet.
The Bare Essentials, Naked Science on 5 Live.
Now, not all of the bugs in the intestine, excuse me, are welcome. Some, like Salmonella or Campylobacter, are common causes of diarrheal diseases, which can require a course of antibiotics to help to clear them up. But there might also be the possibility of using another type of microbe as a living antibiotic to deal with this problem. Delovibrio is a small bacterium that hunts down and invades other bacteria. It multiplies inside them, bursts them, and then escapes in pursuit of fresh prey. So does a dose of these clear up a dose of something else, so to speak? Nottingham microbiologist Liz Sockett works on these bacteria. Hello, Liz.
Hello, Chris.
So where do they normally live, these Delovibrio?
Well, surprisingly, they live almost everywhere. Soil, water, and you can find them in the faeces of human beings and also in mouth swabs of human beings. But they haven't been studied very much in humans until very, very recently.
So tell us a little bit about their life cycle when they do this invasion of other bacteria. What do they actually do? How do they do it and what happens?
Well, I suppose with it being almost hogmanay, a way to envisage a Delovibrio is maybe like a pork sausage trying to invade a haggis. If the haggis is the pathogenic bacterium and the Delovibrio is the pork sausage, then they actually invade through the outer layer of the bacterium, seal up the outer layer, and then eat the nasty bacterium from inside. And they have a set of digestive juices which they release one at a time to break down the components of the pathogenic bacteria. So really they're eating sitting inside for a couple of hours inside that bacterium, which they have killed. And then when everything's eaten up, they then burst out through the outer layer and go on and seek more bacteria.
It sounds like Alien, doesn't it?
It is. It's fantastic, really.
You've made a video of this on YouTube. You've got these glowing green bacteria.
Yes, with a sort of silhouette of the Delvibrio inside. At this point, they've invaded inside, and then they're starting just to digest all of the goodies inside the pathogen. And then eventually they themselves get bigger and replicate using those foods. But when they burst out, they are harmless bacteria to humans and animals. They're just dangerous to bacteria.
So does this mean then that you could potentially apply them? Because if they can track down and hunt down certain microorganisms, because they can't harm our cells, can they?
That's right.
Could you therefore use them in a therapeutic way?
Well, we've been doing some trials where we've looked at the level of salmonella in the guts of chickens, and we've given chickens drinks of living Delvibrio or just drinks of buffers. And we crushed the Delvibrio, we mixed the Delvibrio with crushed antacid so that the chicken would swallow them. Yeah, would swallow them without getting indigestion. And then we looked at the levels of salmonella in the gut, and we found that they were reduced 90% in the Delvibrio treatment compared to just the buffer control. So they had an effect in the chickens. They did not, in our experiment, eradicate the salmonella. And so there's a way to go to actually produce a medicine that might do that, but they certainly reduced the salmonella. And our numbers.
So if they're naturally in humans,
yes.
Does this mean potentially when we get an upset stomach, one of the reasons could be that we've lost our Delvibrio and that therefore other microbes that they would normally have preyed on go out of kilter, that they overgrow because there's nothing to remove them for a while?
It could be. And also it could be that a new pathogen has arrived. And not all pathogens are eaten by Delvibrio, but a large range are. But I think one of the things we just don't know is whether, if you're a person who really never gets sick and has an iron constitution, can eat almost anything and never get an upset stomach, it could be that you have a resident population of Delvibrio. And there just hasn't been really a lot of biology done to look at this. I think scientists are just starting to look at the levels of Delvibrio in the human gut.
We have a question. We have a phone call, actually, from Tommy in the Scottish Highlands. Tommy, what's your question?
It's actually connected with what the scientist has just mentioned there. I had a serious case of cellulitis about 4 years ago. I've had since then had another two.
Cellulitis, of course, being infection in the skin and soft tissues, isn't it?
Yeah. It was a result of I was diving on the west coast of Scotland and stubbed my finger on a barnacle, and that was
what painful.
The doctor said that was what effectively started it. I was given a massive dose of antibiotics. Since that day, I have not been able to eat gluten, whereas before that, I could have eaten anything. I had an iron constitution. I've been tested for celiac, and they say it's negative. Is there a possibility that the antibiotic has completely killed all the bacteria in my gut?
Liz,
including the good ones?
I think it's quite possible. This is probably more Justin's area than mine, actually. But I do think that there's been probably a big shift in who's who in your gut and what they digest for you. And so it could well be that is part of the reason for your change in your digestive function. But I guess Justin might know more than me.
Yeah, let me just add there that, after antibiotic use, there's a common side effect, which is known as antibiotic-associated diarrhea. Oftentimes there's a bacterial cause of this, like Clostridium difficile, that can is a pathogen that lives in many of us at very low levels, typically doesn't cause any problems. But when you wipe out your resident microbiota with antibiotics, it allows this pathogen to emerge and cause disease. And for a long time, there was really no good effective treatment for recurrent C. difficile-associated colitis that occurred after antibiotic use. And recently, researchers, and this actually gets back to a question earlier in the show having to do with dogs and cats licking their bums and why this doesn't make them sick. An effective treatment, it appears, for C. difficile-associated colitis is what's known as a fecal transplant, where feces from a healthy human donor are given to a person that's suffering from digestive problems like colitis, and it effectively reboots their microbiota, establishes a healthy microbiota, establishes a normal interaction with the host, and eradicates the pathogen.
And while we're talking about the effect of antibiotics as well, we've got Mike from Garstang in Lancashire on the phone. Have you got a question for Justin, Mike? Fire away.
Yeah, hi, Justin. I was wondering, can the use of antibiotics in animals cause resistance to those antibiotics in the human population?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question, and there's been a lot of debate about this and a lot of research trying to track resistance genes to try to answer that question specifically. It's clear that antibiotic use, widespread antibiotic use, can lead to the spread of what are known as antibiotic resistance genes. That is the genes that confer resistance to the microbes of for these antibiotics. And once those become widespread, those bacteria can then transmit either themselves that are antibiotic resistant or transmit those genes laterally to other microbes. And so I think it's very likely that antibiotic use in farm animals can lead to the increased prevalence of antibiotic resistance that could affect humans directly.
Thanks, Justin. Joe, one for you, both by text and someone asking something similar. We'll go to on the phone in a second. Anna Senior, can you please clean up an ongoing conversation between me and my husband? Is cold water and soap effective for washing hands, or is hot water and soap required? How does different cleaning regimens make a difference? And that will answer alongside Al is in London. Hello, Al.
Hello.
You've got a similar sort of question.
Yeah, good evening. There are dozens of products in the market for hand washing and even dishwashing. Dishwashing liquids like Fay and all the other liquids. They all contain anti-germ stuff, which is supposed to be antibiotic probably. Yeah. Now, you use all these, and isn't it dangerous on a long term to use these, thereby causing some normal flora to become mutant and
What do you think, Joe? Do you think just soap and water okay, or are we actually doing more harm than good by escalating and using more powerful stuff?
I think just for domestic hand washing, then soap and water is fine. But I think in a hospital environment, obviously, there are significantly more microorganisms that are pathogenic around. So hand sanitizers are used, which have more antimicrobial components to them. Detergents are present in, soaps. They'll solubilise lots of fat, and that should help to clean the hands. So depending on where you are, it's how important it can be.
Joe Verin, thank you very much. Also, Liz Sockett is with us and Justin Sonnenberg. We're talking microbiology. This is Science Night on 5 Live with me, Chris Smith, and with Victoria Gill. More about bugs and bowels coming up in this hour. And still to come, of course, our kitchen scientists, Ben and Dave. They'll be nipping to the nearest loo with their laser pointer-powered microscope that they're building here in the studio, and they'll reveal the microbial life that's lurking around your U-bend.
Meanwhile, do send us your infectious comments and questions. Call us on 0500 909 693 or text 85058, or you can email or tweet us at Naked Scientists.
The Naked Scientists on 5 Live, the bare essentials.
You're listening to Science Night on 5 Live with the Naked Scientists, Chris Smith and Victoria Gill. We're discussing the microbial world in this hour and what's living in us and on us and how these bugs can actually help to keep us healthy.
And we're taking your questions and comments. Do give us a call on 0500 909 693 or text 85058. Or you can email chris@thenakedscientists.com or tweet at Naked Scientists.
And coming up, Ben Vowsler and Dave Ansell, our kitchen scientists, will show you how to build a laser-powered microscope to reveal the bacteria lurking in the loo and other salubrious places. They've even been to the Blue Peter Pond, which is just not far from here. Joe, very quickly, could you please answer this question? Because when you were talking about cleaning hands just now, you didn't mention the hot or cold water, and it's upset some people, and they've texted in on 85058 to say, could you please say hot or cold water? Yes,
hot.
Or no? Joe says hot water is more effective. Victoria.
And we're getting a lot of calls in now, including Matthew from Dunstable, who has a question on the microbiology issue. Go ahead, Matthew.
Oh, good evening, guys. My question is, what's the difference between a microbiologist and a biologist?
Microbiologists are really small biologists. I'm just kidding. Liz Socket, you're a microbiologist. Why do you call yourself a microbiologist as opposed to a biologist, or do you call yourself both?
I suppose I'm both, really. I live in a world where maybe I'm working on the lions, the Dalvibrio, and other people work on the zebras, who are the other bacteria that the Dalvibrio chase after and eat. Most things you can see in microbiology, you can see in biology as well. Mono, who's a great microbiologist, said what is true of elephants is mostly true of E. coli as well, which means that all biology is the same, whether it's micro or macro.
I mean, if we're honest, the number of genes that we actually share with a bacterium is really very high, isn't it? The same gene, if inserted into a microbe, will work just as it does in us, and many of their metabolic genes and things work both in them and us. We have the same genes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, human cells have things in them called mitochondria, which help us digest our lunch and get energy for growth and moving around. And they are actually vestigial microbes that evolved with humans way back in the early stages of Earth's evolution.
And Liz, while we're picking your brain, we have a on the text, we have a question. They didn't leave their name, but they're asking about bacteriophages. They've heard of these things being used instead of antibiotics. Could you explain what a bacteriophage is, and could they replace antibiotics?
Well, bacteriophages are even smaller than bacteria, and they're tiny little viruses that attack bacteria instead of viruses that, say, attack human cells and make us sick. So these little viruses, they look a bit like the Apollo lunar landing module. They have a kind of octagonal head, and then they have spikes that allow them to attach to bacteria, and they inject their genes into bacteria and kill them. Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, they are very cool. They could be useful, and there are actually some products for dogs' ear infections that are being trialled at the moment by veterinarians to use these phages against particular bacteria in the ear. They do work a little bit like a lock and a key, though, in that certain particular bacteria are attacked by a particular phage. So you have to know what infection you have to use the phage. My Dalvibrio are a bit more Catholic in their tastes for eating lots of different bacteria.
And now it's complicated stuff in there then, isn't it? We've got Vivian on the phone from Saltley in North Wales. What's your question, Vivian?
Hello. Well, thank you. Well, I've probably become very germ-phobic in my old age, but for a long time I've been worried about what happens to the quality of the water which goes from the, you know, the main supply up through my house, into my loft space, into a tank which has never had a lid on it, and then into the boiler, and it's not allowed to be heated to more than 70 degrees, and it comes down into my kitchen for me to do my washing up or into the bathroom, and it seems to me, you know, it's how can it be okay?
Is it clean? Joe, can you answer that question? We're also talking about hot water. Is the hot water okay when it comes out of the tap?
You're not going to be drinking it, are you?
No, certainly not drinking it, but I'm going to be washing up in it.
Well, I think that would be OK, then. I mean, if you've got your hot water that's coming out and you're doing your washing up in it, and you've got your detergent as well with your hot water, I think it would be OK.
Thanks, Joe. Robert's in the Isle of Wight. Hello, Robert.
Oh, good evening, team. Thanks for a fantastically interesting programme. My question relates to norovirus. I live on the Isle of Wight, and the Isle of Wight is particularly prone to norovirus for two reasons. A, because we're quite close to Southampton, which is the busiest cruise terminal anywhere in the UK, and lots of people come down there, and that infects Southampton, and some of that comes across the Isle of Wight for people joining cruises or leaving. But the other reason why we get it over here is at this time of year, the Isle of Wight, it's the second busiest time of the year for coach trips to the Isle of Wight, and people come down, say, from Lancashire, where the only hospital in the UK is currently closed to all visitors because of norovirus. So they're coming down to the Isle of Wight, and one of them on the coach has norovirus, and then it contaminates the people on the coach, and then it contaminates the hotel, etc., etc.
Yes.
Now, my question is, I don't have a car, and I travel extensively on public transport. There's a very good public transport network on the Isle of Wight. But I seem to recollect when you were talking about this recently, you were saying that I think you said that even when if people with norovirus sneeze, they're emitting norovirus germs. And my big concern is the public transport itself. In times like this of high risk, should the bus company be, you know, sterilising the handrails and things with a really good high quality cleaner like the one they use for C. difficile, anti-chlorine, or something like that? Because, you know, I've travelled on a couple of buses recently.
And you're worried about what you might have. I mean, your risks and thoughts are probably well-founded, Robert, because there was a study done by Val Curtis from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and she went to train stations across the length and breadth of Britain and swabbed commuters' hands. This was in 2008. And just sent the samples back to the lab to see what they could grow. And it's really interesting because the further north you went up the country, the filthier people became. And they found that people down south had fewer germs on their hands
than people further north.
And they found that in London, 9% of people on average had faecal forms on their hands. And when you went north to, I think they went as far as Glasgow, they found that it went to 29%. And the interesting thing was women, on average, were filthier than men. And that being an administrator was a risk factor for having far higher faecal carriage than doing a manual job or being a labourer. But going by coach was a particular risk factor they found. People who described journeys by coaches were much more likely to be carrying these faecal forms. Now, the point is, if you've got lots of bacteria on your skin, you're also more likely to carry viruses. And as a result of having more viruses on your skin, you're more likely to pick up noro, aren't you? So
I guess you can't argue with data, although I'm mildly affronted.
Yes, me too.
Well, coughs and sneezes spread diseases, but can the same be said for the intestinal equivalent? And could this spread infections in hospital? Well, Ben Vowsler went to the University of Surrey to see microbiologist Simon Parks to find out.
I have two sons, Joe and Josh, who are age 5 and 7, and they've developed a sort of obsession with this homemade sort of biological prank that they've obsessed about sort of farting. And my partner and I, Diane, are constantly sort of reprimanding them for doing this, but they sort of still carry on despite this. And I thought, why do we find this so offensive and why is it dangerous? And can I demonstrate this to my children to stop them doing it? So I thought of some experiments where I could actually sort of prove whether or not farts could transmit sort of various bacteria. So what I've done is taken some Meconcier agar plates that are very good at culturing faecal bacteria and done some very crude experiments where we've exposed the plates to people farting in terms of a naked fart with no pants and no jeans on, and also people farting with underpants and jeans on.
So you've set this up by passing wind, shall we say, on what's called a Meconcier's agar plate. And I believe that you actually have some of these plates to show us.
Yes.
We've now moved into the lab. Now, one of these plates was farted on through jeans and pants, and the other one was exposed to flatulence completely bare. Now, we do like a bit of naked science here, of course, but the two plates, one of them clearly has some colonies on, and the other one looks completely clean. So, Simon, which one's which?
The plate that's totally clean is the one that was exposed with pants and jeans on, so it's obviously the pants and jeans have been very effective at filtering out any faecal bacteria, but the plate that was exposed to the naked emission has a spluttering of red sort of colonies on, and they're very indicative of E. coli. That's a very common sort of faecal bacteria that's a good indicator of faecal contamination.
So we are definitely transmitting bacteria with every flatulence.
Yes, absolutely, yes. I mean, there's such huge numbers of bacteria in a stool that it's inevitable that we will transmit bacteria after flatulence. There's a lot of bacteria in the gut, and of those in the gut, a vast majority are strictly anaerobic, so they can't grow in the presence of a normal atmosphere. They can only grow where there's no oxygen. So obviously those bacteria, whilst they might have landed on the agar plate, that they wouldn't have been able to grow on the agar plate. But the ones that we have isolated are probably E. coli or coliforms that are very common in the gut, and they are very robust bacteria. So they will grow in air, without air, and on agar plates. So these are very capable of surviving outside. So the fact that I picked them up on the Meconcier agar plate, these would be very capable of surviving outside in the environment for hours, if not days.
But could there be anything else that gets transmitted? Is there anything that might get through the genes?
There are obviously viruses that are many orders of magnitude smaller than bacteria. So things like the norovirus, which is a very common cause of vomiting, and some of the astroviruses that are common in causing diarrhea are quite likely to pass through the very fine holes in things like underpants and jeans.
And did you show your sons? Have you convinced them now that farting in the house is not right?
They were quite shocked. One of the first things they asked me were, are they friendly bacteria or are they bad bacteria? And I had to tell them they were relatively friendly bacteria. I mean, most of us fart about a pint glass worth of sort of flatus volume every day. Most of us actually fart during our sleep when all our muscles are relaxed. So even those of us that don't fart during the day, almost all of those will fart during the night unknowingly. So it's very difficult to prevent in a hospital environment.
Surrey University's Simon Parks researching the ability of flatulence to spread diseases. But as he says, at just 1/30,000th of a millimetre across, norovirus particles and similar are even smaller than bacteria. And so pants probably will provide you with very little protection.
Oof. We're taking your questions and comments on these issues. It's 0500 909 693 if you want to give us a call, or text 85058, or you can email chris@thenakedscientist.com or tweet at Naked Scientists. And on Twitter, we have a really fascinating question from Sarah Barrett, who wants to ask of Justin about breastfeeding. How do the antibodies in breast milk help her baby beat a tummy bug? And how are those bugs not broken down in her stomach?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. Breast milk has many very important bioactive compounds. Antibodies are one of those, and it is a way that the mother can transmit properties of her immune system to sop up some bad microbes that might be lurking in the stomach or intestine of her infant. The stomach is fairly effective at killing many things, that many microbes that are passing through our digestive system, but certainly not 100% effective, and these antibodies are a way to supplement that. One other really important compound in breast milk are carbohydrates or oligosaccharides that the mother produces, and it's for a long time been unclear why she would do this, since the baby cannot digest them. And there's been some recent evidence that the mother is producing these carbohydrates in her breast milk that are more complex than lactose. They're called oligosaccharides, and the primary purpose of these compounds, it appears, is to help feed friendly microbes, enabling them to seed the newly formed ecosystem in the infant's intestine.
Justin, we've got this question from Richard in Bristol that's sort of similar to a text on 85058 from Richard in Surbiton. And they're both saying, one of them says he turned into a gardener recently. I don't know how you turn into a gardener. But anyway, he says, I always have dirty hands. I eat lunch with dirty hands. I disagree with antibacterial wipes and sprays. I believe in building up resistance to bacteria. The other Richard's saying, well, what about this evidence for hygiene, excessive hygiene causing a risk of getting more infections and things? Can you comment on what your work shows in terms of the good thing that bacteria do to educate our immune system as we develop, and having them there, the importance of having microbes in our guts?
Yeah, absolutely. There's, a portion of the show, it's clear that some of the callers are very nervous about microbes, and rightly so. In cases of norovirus, if there's severe diarrheal disease, the transmission of viral particles is certainly worrisome. But and certainly the biofilms that Joe studies and eradicating them from important surfaces like those in hospitals is incredibly important. But all of this sanitization comes at a cost of eradicating microbes that might be very important to our biology. There's been major efforts internationally. The Human Microbiome Project in the United States, funded through the National Institutes of Health, the MediHit Consortium in the European Union, and other major contributors like the Beijing Genomics Institute have mapped the complexity of this microbiota. And it's really clear that these microbes are you know, very helpful. They educate our immune system, and in the absence of these microbes, there are major deficiencies in things like development of the immune system. And one of the major challenges in defining a healthy microbiota is really identifying a healthy microbiota. And there's some talk that the microbiota of Western civilizations that's been the major focus of this research may actually not be the most healthy microbiota to study because of the highly sanitized antibiotic-laden environment in which we live.
We need to get back to nature more, I guess, Justin. We're going to have to leave it there because otherwise we're going to put the squeeze on the guys who are desperate to demonstrate what's living in the loo. But Justin Sonnenberg from Stanford, thank you very much. Joe Verrin from Manchester Metropolitan University, thank you very much. And Liz Sockett from Nottingham, thank you very much. Now, having spent a lot of time talking about microbes that are much smaller than a thousandth of a millimetre long, we're actually going to try and look at some. You do need a microscope for this, but Ben and Dave have come up with a simple way to make one using a laser pointer.
Experiments in your kitchen. Science Night on 5 Live.
So Ben, how does this work? Tell us.
Well, we will come back to the laser pointer itself in just a minute, but first what we need to do is find a source of bacteria. So we're going to head out of the studio now and out into the office area that is full of banks of computers, lots of people very busily doing their research, finding important news stories, of course. We're just walking past the guys who've been answering the phone for you all evening. And the reason why we're walking through here is because we're looking for the place that we hope will harbour lots of bacteria, which is, quite predictably, the toilet. So we're now entering the hallowed ground of the 5 Live on-air priority potty, which has been used by all of the most glamorous people at 5 Live. It's been graced by many a glamorous bottom. Dave, what do we need
to
do?
And some unglamorous ones as well.
So I thought we want to get a sample from inside the toilet, which is looking particularly pleasant at the moment. So Ben, if you'd like to get me one.
This is absolutely foul. Hold on, Dave. So here we go, the things we do for work. So I'm going to actually put my hand down into the toilet bowl to get a sample of water. Now,
what was in there?
Oh, you don't want to know. But let's find out if it's got any life in it. So I'm going to carry this back through, hopefully without getting any of this water on me. So now, Dave, what do we actually need to do with this sample?
Well, normally you'd want to use quite an expensive microscope. Microscopes are expensive. They've got very, very accurately created glass lenses in them. And you'd have a look at it, and hopefully you'd be able to see something swimming around in there. Now, this is all a bit high-tech and a bit expensive, so we're going to do something far, far cheaper involving a £5 laser pointer.
So these are the sorts of laser pointers that you might use if you were giving a presentation or that sort of thing. But what? How can we use that as a microscope? What physical properties do we need to rely on?
So instead of using the glass as our lens, we're going to use a droplet of water. So I'm just going to suck up some of that water in a syringe and then try and get a droplet off the end of the syringe.
OK, so this has to be a sort of spherical droplet. Is it the shape that's important?
That is important. Lenses are curved, and this bends light, which is going to be very important in a moment. I'm now going to turn the laser pointer on.
And while Dave turns the laser on, I'm going to dim the lights in here. Now, we are pointing the webcam at this at the moment, so if you want to see what we can see, then do please look at the webcam. What I can see right now is a bright green dot, just like you'd expect from a laser pointer, while Dave aligns it. And it's glowing very brightly on the screen, but now that Dave's got it lined up well, instead of a dot, I'm getting a really bright green glow, but it's not consistent. I hope you can see this on the webcam. There are things floating in it, little circular rings of shadow that are just moving around through this diffuse green glow that's filling up an entire meeting chart. Dave, what's happening? For a start, how is that so big instead of just the point?
So what's happening is that curved droplet of water is bending the light inwards, and it's coming towards a focus. And near that focus, even a very, very small object is going to create a shadow. The light's then going to kind of cross over itself and then spread out, creating this sort of metre across blob of light on the wall. So something a hundredth of a millimetre across inside the droplet is now blown up to maybe a centimetre across on the screen.
So even though these things are tiny, because the light source and that, in particular, that focus point is so close to them, it means that the shadows they cast are very big. So what are these blobs? What do we think they might be?
Well, these seem to be fairly dull blobs, not a lot moving around. So they could be dust, they could be bacteria, they could be dirt, they could be dust. It's very, very hard to tell. So we talked about going to the Blue Peter Pond earlier. So I've got some water from Blue Peter Pond, which might be a bit more exciting.
Now, true to form, this is one that we prepared earlier. So this is actual Blue Peter Pond water. Now, toilets, of course, we think of as being unhygienic places, but they're reasonably clean because it's quite clean water. The Blue Peter Pond water is absolutely livid with things. We're getting the same bright green with lots and lots of little circular blobs, some of which are sort of squidging along and seem to be moving.
So if they're moving around, they must be alive, I'd have thought, because things can be moved around by the water, but some of them are actually swimming around and kind of swirling around the place. So I'm pretty sure those are some kind of bacteria with some kind of little flagella on the back, acting like a propeller, pushing them along. But to be honest, I'm a physicist, so exactly what they are, I couldn't tell you.
Well, we do have a microbiologist with us. Joe, what do you think we might be finding in a pond?
I'm looking at it from across the room. I would imagine in a pond you'd be getting algae, and you'd also be getting some protozoa. So they look a bit bigger than what you saw before in the toilet water. And you can see that some of them seem to be moving actively rather than just sort of floating and being washed around. So I reckon algae and protozoa.
So we've not got microbiological proof that presenters have been weeing in the Blue Peter Pond then.
Although it's not impossible.
Dave, this is beautiful, but could it make a practical microscope?
Very unlikely. You couldn't get a good enough picture.
Well, there we go. So you can make a sort of a microscope that makes a beautiful picture using a laser pointer and a bit of really quite unpleasant water.
Ben Vassler and Dave Ansell, thank you very much. Just time to mention Barry in Surrey, who says he'd recommend setting light to farts then as a way of sterilising them. And Keith in Hertfordshire says, well, how much protection would the thong give you? That's it for this edition of Science Night. Thank you to our guests for their insights, and to you at home for listening and for taking part. We'll be back with another Science Night next year. In the meantime, if you'd like to find out a bit more about the Naked Scientists, find us online at nakedscientists.com. Howard Benson was the producer this evening. My name's Chris Smith. Have a very happy new year and goodbye.
First for breaking news and the best live sport.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.